This is a Digital Music Trends 169 on the 6th of February 2014. The Midem interviews featuring Merlin, Times Music, Impressive PR, Jukely, Rock in Rio, Believe, the Malaysia recording industry, Frascona Law, Pledge Music, The Orchard, The Collective, and the Hertz, Liechtenstein and Young. DMT's coverage of Midem 2014 was made possible by CI, the leading provider of digital delivery services to the independent community. So make sure you go and check out the website on ci-info.com. Hello everyone and welcome to the Midem 2014 special of Digital Music Trends. I am Andrea Leonelli and this is the weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. A packed episode of DMT today with extracts from 10 out of the 30 odd interviews that I recorded over the past few days in Cannes. I can assure you that the other 20 interviews are just as good, I just haven't quite had the time to edit them all yet. And I will be releasing a full-length interview from Midem every day over the course of February, so look out for them on DMT's YouTube and SoundCloud channels. My goal for this show was to look outside of the US and UK verticals, so there'll be a lot of discussions around international markets and also quite a bit of focus on the independent sector. As for Midem 2014, I once again really enjoyed the conference. It was my fifth year. Certainly, it's had to adapt to a decreasing number of delegates over the last few years. And for example, this year, the main conference hall was smaller than usual, but that also meant that it was always packed and there was a stronger connection between the audience and the delegates. Also, I've heard from lots of people that were in Cannes this year, both during and after the conference, that they've done some really good business out there and had some great meetings. So that's certainly good news for the event. And let's start this week's Midem recap with my catch-up with Charles Caldas, CEO at Merlin, talking about the organization's success in representing the independent sector worldwide and the international markets showing the most activity for them. So Merlin has had great success in the last few years, consolidating and representing the independent sector worldwide, especially when it comes to negotiating with streaming services. And so, and in a way, maybe that has also helped the independents achieve the great success that we had on those platforms, claiming such a huge percentage of streams compared to the overall market share, really.
Yeah. Look, I think, from a Merlin perspective, I would hope that we've certainly facilitated a lot of success for independents, that we've opened the opportunity for them to perform on these platforms. The one thing that's become clear to us is the more digital the market gets, the better it is for independence. You know, the old world music market was dictated by financial power. So the labels that had the most ability to purchase retail space and to purchase advertising and to purchase marketing programs would always get to the front of the line. Yeah. I think the great thing that streaming platforms have created is a much more open platform by which people can get to music. And if you can combine those vast platforms with the bundling of those platforms into Facebook, the ability to share and discover music in a much more direct way has certainly contributed to the success of independence. You know, we saw a survey in the UK this year where the official charts company looked at the performance of independence in the charts over the last 10 years. And the last 3 years have been three of the most successful years ever for independence in the UK charts. And I think there's a number of dynamics at play here. It's the digital market's been good for independence. The fact that there's less of these shop windows to walk through for consumers mean you can discover more broadly and you can consume more broadly in a much more simple way. But it's also an investment thing, I think. You know, the major labels have been consolidating. The physical business is tough. The majors are shrinking, but the independents are growing. Major labels have, in a lot of cases, stopped investing in domestic repertoire that's not sung in English. Independents are filling that space. So if you look at markets like Spain and Italy, independent labels are really starting to drive the growth in the market.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the international markets as well, because that's an area that I'm really interested in. And if we look at the worldwide picture, where are you seeing the most activity when it comes to Merlin? Are you seeing territories that maybe have emerged over the last couple of years that you wouldn't have expected beforehand?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the big surprise for everybody is obviously the Nordic territories in the wake of the Spotify launch, and the levels of adoption of streaming in those markets is extraordinary. But we have to remember those markets also never really had a streaming They never had a dominant download culture. So they've kind of gone from physical to piracy to streaming. So there's, you know, and we certainly see these different dynamics play out culturally and depending on the consumption mode in different markets.
Yeah.
I think the interesting thing for me is both the way that we're seeing individual markets develop, and, you know, and the growth is pretty consistent in terms of where these streaming platforms are actually available locally. The dynamic I'm really interested in at the moment is the fact that, you know, in some ways the global marketplace for locally produced music seems to be becoming more of a reality. So we had a meeting, for example, this morning with an Italian label we represent. In the streaming platforms, their number one revenue source is the USA. Even though they're working in Italy with Italian repertoire, you know, and I think that's a dance music thing. It's about the fact that, you know, that whole EDM thing's taking off in America, that the web facilitates discovery of that music from wherever it is really interesting. And I think that so we're not only unbundling traditional retail, but we're unbundling or unwinding all of those territorial boundaries in terms of where music's consumed, which is really exciting.
And you provide a whole suite of services as well. I mean, you've just launched a new dashboard on Merlin. So what is that all about and how does that help your members?
Well, I think one of the responsibilities we feel for the labels we represent is to help them understand the changing market dynamics.
Yeah.
So there's always been a pattern that we've seen, for example, when a streaming service comes into a market, there's a lot of fear and, you know, apprehension about, is it going to kill the physical market? Is it going to kill downloads? You know, the sky's falling down, we don't know what it is. But we're now, having done this over several territories and several services, there's almost a pattern that emerges in terms of what happens when a new market opens up to streaming. What are the adoption patterns? What are the signs that we look for in terms of growth? So the dashboard is in part so we can start sharing some of that information with our members. And in part, it's just about the fact that you have to be really fast in the digital market. So reporting and payment and flowing through the information of what's actually happening on the platforms really quickly requires efficiency. So for us, it's a tool, it's sort of a business tool that's been built really to maximize the efficiency of the way we interact with our members. But I think underneath that, it's also hopefully going to be a tool by which they can better understand how the market evolves, what the measures are, and what they can learn from one market to another.
And we continue with my chat with Mandar Thakur, COO of Times Music. We chat about the state of the recorded music industry in India, take a look at some of the most prominent labels in the country, and the streaming services that are available. And talking about the state of the recorded music industry, are the models that are applied in India essentially very similar to the ones that we have here, in the UK or in the US, as far as licensing, as far as record sales, royalties, and all those sort of host of issues?
I think the models are pretty much similar, give or take a little bit. But what could be different is the structure of the industry and the structure of copyright, of the financial end of the copyright monetization process. So let me sort of take a step back. In terms of business model, if you got the CD sales that are like anywhere else, you've got downloads and you've got streaming. And as usual, whilst the streaming businesses, like I said on yesterday's panel, all the streaming guys go around talking about, we're building great social media, we're building fan following, we're building blah, 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 and wait for the pennies to drop. Fact of the matter is, when you look at the rest of the world, which is outside of the US, UK, and Europe, and particularly South Asia and that diaspora, you will realize that those countries musically are about the song, not about the artist. Because of a large inbuilt film culture, a large 100-year-old musical heritage, markets like India, music and movies are one and the same. Every movie is a musical. So there is no real artist out there. There is a director who knows what song he wants. Music composer composes it to a brief. It's all sort of work for hire. So it's a created track, like an advertisement jingle. In that sort of a situation, all you're talking about is plays, because and that's so those bits and pieces like that differ in an Indian business scenario. Now when it comes to copyright, that's a whole different ball game. For the longest time, I always said, copyright was considered the right to copy as opposed to the right to protect and exploit it. Last year, the industry got together with music composers. The government stepped in and a brand new spanking copyright law got refurbished, which finally legally recognized mechanicals. So there is an interim sort of rate that we've agreed with the music publishers and, you know, the record industry and the composers, and that sort of rate goes on for mechanicals. There's a, you know, fully functional copyright, performance collection society playing on, which will soon be administering mechanicals. So, you know, bits and pieces from a new IP-based structure, that's all coming together now. In terms of marketing, sales exploitation, I think those lines are pretty much similar.
And looking at the landscape, you're talking about being an independent label, essentially. You know, how do you see, what's the landscape like in terms of majors? Are the majors present in India? And what is their market share, essentially?
Oh, well, okay, yeah. I mean, look, the majors are all present in India. They have been present since the last close to 40 years, 50 years, perhaps more, in different shapes and forms, licensees, holding companies, back to licensing. So structurally, there are the international majors and then there are the local majors, right? So we are sort of like we operate independent. We're not baggaged and with the largeness of a corporation. Our core company is probably bigger than most of the majors, but we are allowed, because we're in a new business, we are allowed to pretty much chart our own course globally that way. I think structurally speaking, give or take a few million. This is a US 260 or 270 million business, out of which repertoire-wise, local repertoire is the predominant repertoire. I mean, we've just got, you know, that's one of the things about India. It's all homogeneously produced local repertoire because we've got a far bigger musical heritage than the rest of the world. So local repertoire rules, out of which 75% are Bollywood film musicals and then the rest is non-film. Now, on the physical market, out of the 100%, only 1.5% is international music, right? And it's remained, only 5% is international music. On mobile music, which is ringback tones, IVR-based mobile radio, it's only 1.5%. And that has got to do with the fact that it's not a smartphone-based system. Very, you know, the lowest strata of society also uses that. And that's, they don't consume international music, right? But when it comes to streaming and when it comes to iTunes, it's a different picture. I would estimate an iTunes to have perhaps a 26% share of international music, only because of the profile of the customer who buys an iPhone. It's expensive and upwardly mobile. When it comes to streaming services, a newer picture emerges because now people have choice. They can search on a larger screen. Most of the catalogs are available. So all other forms of music come up. So the percentages keep sort of changing. Now, in terms of splits between digital and physical, most Indian record labels will be at an average, maybe a weighted average median of between 70 and 75% as digital income. So we are sort of far ahead of them, but that digital income includes mobile income, which is a larger chunk, right? And in terms of structure, T-Series, which owns a large chunk of Bollywood repertoire, is the leading music company out of India, which is followed by Saregama, which is pretty much does catalog management. It's a 100-year-old company, ex-EMI licensee. So they size-wise, they're sort of number two, but not very active on a day-to-day basis. And number three is Sony Music, which is as good as a local major. I mean, they're like a 360 company. They're involved in Bollywood, regional music. I mean, it's fairly large, right? And after that, then there is a fourth layer, which includes people like us. So that would be us, Universal EMI. Universal EMI would be a little above us in terms of revenue. And then there is us at a sort of... And that, I think, composes the sort of top five labels out of India. And then there are the smaller labels like Tips, Venus, and these labels have been very big, but, you know, the business has turned more to film production. And the music business is sort of, they've not gone ahead acquiring a lot, so they've sort of slipped down onto it. So that is the gradation structure of the industry.
And so you're talking about, you know, traditional methods of marketing. We talked about the importance of mobile for accessing for ringtones as well. And of course, the fact that not that many people have smartphones yet also affects the adoption of streaming services. But there are some streaming services in India. So what are the bigger ones?
The number one streaming service is Gaana.com, which is incidentally owned by our parent company. Then the second one now is a service called Saavn. The original number one was Dingaana.com, which sort of had some cash investor problems, and they're sort of on hold at the moment, I believe. So that sort of leveraged Gaana up. Gaana was the original number one, you know, a year back, and Saavn at number two. Then there are other services like the Nokia Ovi Store, which is very big in India. Yeah, I'm probably one of the few. Yes, and then there are the sort of Indian businesses, streaming and download, that either work with other aggregators, perhaps you know, the iTunes, the Amazons, the Netflixes. These are things like Raga.com, iMusti. These are based out of US, but catering to a fairly large Indian diaspora. So a clutch of these are the local homegrown music services. Of course, there is iTunes that's present. And YouTube is huge in India. Like, huge is like an understatement, and they're growing in leaps and bounds. So I think pretty much this coming year, you may have the entry of the global sort of streaming service coming in, you know, perhaps some point this year. And that, I believe, will sort of kickstart a war, because India is about war. Any industry, you know, you look at the telecom industry, you look at Coke, Pepsi, you look at MTV, Channel V. The country is fairly voracious in its appetite. The peculiarity of India is that it skips technology. So, you know, if you go back, the pager never even got born in India. People jumped off to mobiles, and when mobiles started getting big, the smartphone revolution took off. You know, so it's a generation skipping sort of country out there.
And back to the UK, I catch up with Mel Brown from Impressive PR, one of the most prominent music PR agencies in the country. We discuss the most important media outlets in the UK for music, the importance of PR agencies going out there and discovering new bands, doing some A&R themselves, and the continued rise of independent music in the UK.
So, talking about the way PR has evolved over the last 5 years or so, there's been a bit of a sea change in how really everything works. You know, there's a lot of traditional media stuff still going on, but there's been definitely a shift towards digital, which has really changed the way you do business, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Although in the UK, I think we're quite different to other territories, especially America, in that we still have the majority of the print publications that we have done forever. Over the last kind of, I suppose, 10 years really, we've only seen about 3 or 4 major publications close. So we still are print driven. Online is becoming more and more important, and there's some key websites that you have to kind of get on. And also what's happened is the magazines that are traditionally print, their counterpart online sites have become more successful and, you know, becoming more successful than the magazines. Unfortunately, I don't think the industry has shifted necessarily, because when we're doing PR, the record labels and management still want to see the print.
Right.
So there's still a little bit of work to be done there.
Absolutely.
But yes, of course, you can't dismiss the statistics for the key online sites, you know, and also the demographic is obviously a lot younger for the websites.
You mentioned A&R, and I want to pick up on that, because you know, you kind of act as an A&R in a sense, because you get so many submissions by bands that you're talking about, independent acts that want to be represented by you. And so how much time do you spend listening to new bands and your team?
Oh my God, a lot. And in fact, my company is 19 and a half years old now. Even from the very start, I think I was probably one of the first PRs to actually be A&R and PR, because that's how I found Muse and Coldplay. Like, they were totally unsigned when I started working with them. You know, Muse was just in the process of signing. Coldplay hadn't signed at all. So even back then, it was absolutely crucial, and that's continued. I would say I find probably, and I represent 70% of my roster, is music that I've found. So being proactive in finding. So I go to South by Southwest every year. I go to CMJ in New York every year. And they're great places to find new talent. And obviously in the UK, we have the Great Escape,
yeah,
which is fantastic, and it's grown and grown and grown. And I think that that's brilliant because it also brings overseas acts.
Yeah.
It's not just about UK talent. And I think it's a mini South by Southwest.
Yeah. And the independent music scene in the UK has really become even healthier, I think, over the last few years. It's just so strong. And, you know, do you see that trend continuing?
100%. It's interesting because I had a conversation with a radio plugger that I've hired in for one of my projects only this week. And I actually had a conversation with him and said, does it matter from Radio 1's perspective that the artist is not signed to a major label or a big independent? And he's a big, big plugger, a great plugger who looks after One Republic, The Script, Ollie Murs, very successful UK acts. And he said, no, the music just has to be good. And there has to be kind of maybe a story. It's not even about stats for Radio 1 now.
Yeah.
So no, I mean, I think, you know, obviously, to be a success, it is a cumulative thing. All your ducks need to be lined up, and it's a piece of a jigsaw puzzle, and there's a little bit of luck involved to become successful as an artist. But no, I mean, I love hearing new music and breaking new bands.
And startups are out in force at Medium this year, especially thanks to the Medium Lab competition. And I caught up with Bora Selic from Jukely.
And so, you know, let's talk about Jukely. First of all, let's introduce the company to all the viewers and listeners out there.
Sure. Jukely is a matchmaker for concerts and friends. When you sign up with it, we learn what you're listening to, what you like, what your friends are listening to, and what they like. And we match you with upcoming concerts, and we match you with friends to go with, even friends of friends to go with, to create an open social conversation around live music and bring people together.
So going from one city to 10 cities, so how did that process work, and how are you finding users are reacting to Jukely? Because, you know, you showed me in the prep a very good example, which is a list of people that are, if you just do a search, actually, if you're back home, if you type concert and alone or gig and alone, and you're going to find loads of people that are tweeting about going to a gig alone or thinking about whether they should go to a gig alone or not. So, how do you find people are reacting to the opportunity of having the service now?
Yeah, so we actually haven't fully unleashed the power of what we wanted to build. We changed course a little bit in the beginning. You know, where we wanted to go to is, you know, create the social environment for an open conversation for people finding each other and going to concerts together. It took us a while. We just submitted a release to the App Store now. So there are multiple things people are using Jukely for. First of all, they love the design of the app, thanks to Andrew and his, you know, Kickstarter design awesomeness that, you know, we're getting a lot of accolades. So at first we started getting all the designers downloading the app and playing with it. Oh, this is great. You know, so we did the iOS 7 version of it, which is like all. So people really liked, you know, the way it was built. And then we started breaking into different areas. Our strongest markets are electronic music and indie music. So like we start with the startup people and the designer type people, hipsters who listen to a lot of indie music. And then we started making all these deals with the clubs and the promoters who promote electronic music. So we started getting like the teenagers, 18 to 24, which I call real people, not like the startup people. So that's when you start seeing the actual potential of your real product. Once the, you know, it's, you see the, you observe it outside of the tech crowd. And now, you know, we're observing patterns in those cities and how people are using Jukely, you know, how they engage with their friends, and we're learning lessons, and we call it, you know, nailing the playbook for cities. We haven't nailed yet. I think we're 80% there. Some of our cities, like we're very strong in New York because that's where we built up for a few months, and then we're strong in LA, Chicago, San Francisco, Miami, Vegas. We're building up in Seattle, Portland, Denver, and then we want to launch in 10 other cities. And of course, you know, there needs to be a formula. You know, we launched in 10 cities because, you know, Apple was going to feature us, and they wouldn't feature you if you're only one city.
Sure.
And we wanted to take advantage of that, of course. And we kind of jumped in, you know, got a bunch of downloads, got our 50 minutes of fame there. And now, you know, we're like, we have to blossom the cities into you know, something special. And we're getting there. Yeah, these communities are really important, you know, because it's a social product. It's a friend. You need to see your friends and friends of friends, and people get recommended to you in your network. And it cannot feel empty. We cannot afford the app to feel empty. So actually, I'm a little bit nervous now because the next release that's going to be in the app stores probably sometime next week is completely open. You see, actually, you'll be able to see the people and talk to the people. So far, it was kind of still closed, so yeah. It was a little bit more protected in that sense. But right now, like, it's going to be more transparent what's happening in the city. Like, you're going to go onto the show and see, like, how many people are actually engaging with it and who can you hit, who can you send a message to. So it'll be interesting. I'm excited for it. A little bit nervous also.
And from a startup to a very established company, I chat with Denis Ladegaillery, CEO of Belief Digital, on the company's expansion over the past few years, the digital market in Russia, the rise of streaming services, and how that impacts their business.
London. So the company has grown incredibly in the last 7 years, and you now have offices all over the world. So first of all, let's talk a little bit about that process of expanding a music company and making it so incredibly successful, even whilst there's so many people that are, you know, struggling in this industry. So what's the key to Belief's success so far?
The secret recipe. it's making sure that when you talk to clients, it's our clients basically trust them, and they trust them because we are prompt with them. We provide them services. Yeah. We do what we say to them. So I think that's basically been the basis. And then for companies like us, I think it's either you're international or you're not. I mean, I was looking at our stats in the UK a couple of days ago. For all of our UK labels, UK sales represent 25% of our revenues. 75% comes from Germany, the US, the rest of Europe. So if you don't have offices in those countries to be able to support an artist when something happens, then you're not doing your job properly. Yeah. That's why for us, international expansion was absolutely key. What we see is, I mean, Europe has historically always been our focus and remains our focus because for all of our clients, it's the number one market for UK labels. They sell music pretty much in the vicinity, I would say, Scandinavia, France, Germany, Italy, and then maybe Australia, the US. So Europe remains a very strong focus. And then we have opened about 20 new offices around the world last year. Essentially, as Apple expanded into this market, this created a new opportunities for us. Yeah. And what we've seen is some very strong, fantastic markets, Russia, Turkey, especially some of for our European labels in terms of volumes. Russia, for example, has become our fifth largest territory worldwide.
Wow.
Very significant volumes.
And that's incredible because it's a very challenging territory for most rights holders, right?
We now have like five people in Moscow working for Belief Digital. When we spoke about opening an office there a year and a half ago, everybody was telling us, you guys are crazy, champion of the world for piracy. And I mean, what we see is always the same story. If you're able to provide good service, and which is a country where Apple is very strong, where people buy iPhone $600, $700. When it comes to buying an album for $499, $599, then people are happy when the solution is here. And we see, I mean, we've done some with some top local Russian artists. We've Zemfira, which is our top artist there. Last album was released about a month ago. I was looking yesterday. We've sold 48,000 copies on iTunes digitally in a month and a half. So it's great. Some of these very good surprises in some of these territories.
And in Russia, of course, you know, talking about iTunes, and is that like still like, you know, the by far the main driver of sales?
Google Music is so, which launched a little bit later, has seen great success, very strong early numbers. And we see it's still a market where ringback tone providers locally are still very strong, but the structure is clearly evolving like many of those markets.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, what we see, interestingly, the conclusion we've come to is, and I've spent a lot of my time traveling around, you almost have three market phases. Is one where dominated by wireless carriers for 3-4 years, and then usually Apple comes in, takes 50, 60, 70, 80% of the market, and last three, four years. And then the last phase of the market, Deezer, Spotify, RDO come in the market and then start gaining some market share. So it, we really see this all around the world. So which means you need to have the understanding of local market to be able to basically do your job properly as a distributor.
Sure. And you know, we're looking at in the UK and in the US, the 2013 has been reported of the first year where digital track sales started declining. And of course, the streaming is growing dramatically. So does that shift sort of your revenue model in a sense, or is essentially just a substitution of the same?
Tough question. It's a very tough question. What we see is the way we look at it is in two ways. One, it's basically what's the size of the pie in the market, and then how is that pie being divided on download market, on streaming market. The good news right now, what we're seeing is that when the pie is divided, it's actually more favorable in streaming markets for our clients, because streaming tend to have a higher level of discovery. Yeah. And typically, in a market like France, for example, where we have an average market share about 7%, on streaming services, our market share is almost 10%.
Wow.
So almost 40% higher. Because people are discovering more music, it's easier, you don't have to buy a track. So it's actually favorable. What we are seeing also on the other end, though, in the switch, we think there's the question as to whether the switch to streaming in the short term actually for the overall pie creates value or destroys value. And I think the answer there is very different.
Yeah.
In a market where obviously, the download market is not built when streaming picks up early. It creates additional value. In some markets like France, what we're seeing is once you start having a customer switch from download to streaming, you are actually destroying value in the short term. So it's a mix, I would say, a little bit too early to tell. And it really depends a lot on the services, on the growth of the services of Deezer, Spotify in each territory. But I would say as a whole, in the medium term, it clearly has an impact of flattening out the growth on the market. Yeah. I mean, what we see clearly, we see the trend in the US with declining track downloads last year. We see the trend in the UK. We see the trend in France, which are all top five worldwide markets. So it's, I would say it probably has a negative impact short term on growth and then varying by market.
Yeah, sure.
And it was a pleasure to catch up with Martin Frascona from Frascona Law. And we talk about the law firm's international focus and the need to adapt to each territory's particular market needs.
Everybody kind of has different backgrounds in the legal world. Mine is with working with international artists. So currently my clientele spans 34 countries and six continents. So it's a very interesting kind of mix. And luckily not something that a lot of attorneys kind of focus on international aspects.
Absolutely. And that's something I try to do on the show as well. I try and involve as many people from different continents as possible. Because usually the conversation is always based around UK, US, maybe Europe, but nobody ever thinks about Asia or South America.
There's other things out there, that's for sure.
And so you're talking about 34 countries. So I'm really interested in the international outlook of the music industry. So where are you seeing the most inquiries coming from? Is there a particular area of the world where you're seeing, you know, a buzz about the industry there, about what's happening?
Loaded question. So let me... you know, I've got an artist right now that she's done very well in the States, and she's based in the States. Most of my clients are outside of North America, but she's done very well on YouTube, and she has over 300 million hits on her YouTube channel. Obviously, that has gotten her label attention within the States now, but most of her analytics are coming from Indonesia and Malaysia. And it's strange to kind of watch that market take off. Now, from a sales perspective, maybe not the most attractive. From a talent perspective, very, very talented in those areas. So it kind of depends on what you're looking for. The German market has kind of been an area of attention with U.S. labels lately. Switzerland is a big area. Austria has been a big area. Sweden is now getting on the map. And it's interesting because, as you know, genres change from market to market, from country to country. So whatever you're identifying as pop within the U.S., that may not be what is classified as pop within Sweden. So it's really interesting, you know, for artists. The example I typically give, if you're an artist in San Diego and your music may not be selling in San Diego, my question is, why are you trying to plug it in San Diego? The appropriate market, the appropriate sales market may be Dublin, Ireland. So the X factor is, how do you move your product to Ireland? How do you generate a sustainable career in Ireland? And that's where you get into kind of the international aspects of what I do.
Looking at formats as well, you were talking about Germany and you know, Indonesia, and different parts of the world have really completely different approaches. The stats are different from territory to territory when it comes to physical sales, digital adoption, streaming adoption. Their methods of consumption like vary wildly. So do you have to adapt each artist's strategy to the territory where that they're targeting when it comes to also generating revenues from recorded music sales?
Yeah, again, I think it goes back to the type artist and what is their strategy. So if they're trying to acquire a major label, obviously you've got an end game in mind there. So how are you trying to generate visibility to get them on the label map in a particular territory? But you're right, all the trends are completely different. So I did an article for Medium, this was maybe 6 months ago, talking about the Brazilian music trends and the trends in Argentina. Completely different. In one market, you know, artists are found on YouTube. On the other one, they're found on local radio. So you've got this total paradigm shift. If you really have got to understand the market that you're trying to go into, which brings a lot of legal problems as well, or legal things you must maneuver. Another example I usually give when I do lectures is, you think of just a simple Twitter account.
Yeah.
All bands have a Twitter account. All bands have a Facebook account. You cross over intellectual property borders within seconds. The second you take a picture on your Twitter account and you send it off, you may have four or five people in different countries retweet that. You've jumped over four or five different legal boundaries and four or five different IP laws. And you've got to understand what you're dealing with, because a lot of times, if your end goal is to sign with a label, the label wants to acquire the intellectual property. That's part of their business model. So they want to make sure that they can monetize all social media aspects. Well, when they do that, there's typically a monetary amount that they'll kind of put forward when they offer to a band. So they'll pay X amount to acquire the social media. When you're dealing with that and you're a band, you've got to understand who owns that social media. The second a label puts down money and says, we'd like to buy that, you don't want to then be discussed within the band of, hey guys, how are we going to divide this money? And I see a lot of those problems, unfortunately, take place. But then you just add another layer to it when you're jumping over international borders, depending on what are you doing with your social media as well. So it's a, you said fun, I'd say fun sometimes issue to deal with. But yeah, I enjoy what I do. I really do.
And it's always fun to catch up with the Pledge Music team. This time it was Benji Rogers and Paul Barton. We talk about the evolution of the company over the past 12 months, artists coming back to the platform for a second or third campaign, the community around Pledge, and much more.
Pledge has grown a lot over the past year. On the product front, let's start with that. What's been happening?
Sure. So we're actually in the midst of a rebuild of the entire platform, basically from the ground up. And it's going to focus, it's going to be a lot more artist-centric. One of the bits of feedback that we've been consistently getting from artists is, we love what Pledge does, but we kind of, it's very heavily Pledge branded.
Yeah.
And so the new platform is going to have a lot of, you know, new types of design features that are going to be more about featuring the artist brand and their thing, while still retaining all the benefits of the platform itself. But, you know, platform-wise, feature-wise, you know, we've been getting a lot more into the chart eligibility needs of a lot of our artists. We're getting a lot more into fulfillment and manufacturing, because that's a big thing that artists have wanted. And led, I think, in large part by the UK team, and Paul and his team in particular, is that the label integrations, the types of campaigns that we're doing, we've had to adapt what the platform does for them. And we've been absolutely open to doing the maximum we can while still retaining the fan experience and making sure that keeps important. So,
and looking at how the you know, artists are using Pledge. Of course, you know, you're coming to the point where artists are using Pledge for the second time around, or maybe even third, who knows. But how is their approach evolving for artists that have used it before and are coming back to the platform? Do you find that they're refining their approach, they're refining the way that they present their and they conduct their campaigns?
They're actually getting better at it, I find, because so what happens when you launch a second campaign, the first pledgers are auto-notified about the new one as it goes live. So there's a big kind of initial burst. And one of my favorite ones is you know, watching someone like Matthew Mayfield, who's on three campaigns. His first campaign's, you know, under 200 pledges. His second campaign, over 500 pledges. His third, close to 1,000. So you see it growing. And, I mean, you know, bands like Hawkeyes, who did their first campaign and second campaign, you can see that there's a progression, because now the existing fans are ready and they're actually excited about it. And in the best possible scenario, an artist says, listen, I'm thinking of doing another one. What do you guys want to see? The fans will give their feedback. And that's another thing. One more thing to add that we've added too in the last year, which I mentioned, is we've now got a survey functionality within the updates. So an artist can upload 5 different versions of the artwork. Fans can vote for which one they like. Upload the entire album. Fans can choose sequences. So they're able to interact a lot more. And so when a second campaign launches, we're like, hey, by the way, you should offer this technique, you should offer this one.
Yeah. Looking at the community around Pledge as well, I think last year when we were talking, you were actually saying that the majority of people that pledge have pledged for a very particular artist and may not have necessarily pledged for other campaigns on the platform. How has that evolved over the last year? Have you seen more people come back to Pledge purely because they're used to the platform now and invest in artists they might not necessarily have a personal connection with?
It's changed a huge amount. What we noticed was we started to get a weekly report, and we were noticing that if we put in a certain type of artist, that they could expect between 30% and 40% of their first week's pre-orders to come from existing Pledge users. And we now have a recommendation engine built in, and the new version of the site will also have will surface recommendations in different ways. Because ultimately fans are saying, we want this experience with more bands. And our job now, and particularly in the A&R role, and which Paul can speak to more, is to go get them the bands that they want to see. It's not just the established big bands, it's also they want to discover new bands and not just listen to them, but help them out or, you know, be a part of it. And that's the most exciting thing. You know, we saw on one campaign, 48% of this artist's pledges came from within our system. That's 48%. That's a huge amount. And that's just fans. You know, we're all music fans. We all want the same thing. We just, you know, we found a way to connect them all. And when similar artists launch at the same time, you see this cross-pollination of pledging going on. So artists who know each other sharing in updates and going back and forth.
It's quite addictive as well. Right?
It's absolutely addictive.
I think our customer base also has, you know, we've got a lot of vinyl junkies, yep. We've got a lot of t-shirt junkies, we've got a lot of screen print poster junkies. So I think our new search engine, which you're able to search via product rather than, as well as via artist and genre, I think that will really help, because you know, our customers want the box sets. You know, what sort of box sets do we have on offer on Pledge Music? And they can bring up the whole host of artists that are running box sets or running vinyl or running t-shirts. And, you know, so customers want to be able to spread out their sort of search into those areas. So, yeah, it's exciting.
And let's move to Brazil, as I interviewed Rock in Rio's CEO, Luiz Justo, on the festival's history, the importance of brands, the plans for a Las Vegas edition, and the recent partnership with SFX.
So first of all, you know, can you introduce Rock in Rio to viewers or listeners that might not have be that familiar with it?
All right. Rock in Rio, we are completing 30 years of festival next year. So we're beginning back in 1985 in Rio de Janeiro. That's why the name of the festival is Rock in Rio, and more than rock as an attitude than the music style, because in Rock in Rio you see a lot of different music styles. Yeah. There are always more than 100 different artists in every edition. And back then in 1985, the project was born in a way that Brazil, you know, in the 80s, was a very poor country. Now we are in a very good ascension. But back on that time, you can imagine that a festival to bring all the main international celebrities to Brazil, it costs a lot. And the price of tickets in Brazil back on that time was as like $8 compared to 80, what was the usual price. So the way of of that that Rock in Rio needs to be, you know, financially feasible. It needs to be huge in terms of audience. So it was not a megalomany of the founder, that is Roberto, a big Brazilian entrepreneur, but we really need to be something big in the aspects of the audience. So the very first edition was 1.3 million people in 1985 with, you know, all the main artists like Queen, with Freddie Mercury.
That's the famous performance.
That was a really amazing performance there. But not also, you know, all the heavy metal sets as Iron Maiden, AC/DC, Black Sabbath back that days, and pop artists. So it was a really, you know, unique for Brazil, because it was the very, very, you know, first festival that brings the attention of the world of entertainment to Brazil. And as I was saying, it needs to be huge in terms of audience, and also it needs to be a platform to sponsorships and brands to make it happen. So sure. In the very first edition, Brahma, that was a local Brazilian beer, invested $25 million in sponsorship, and Rock in Rio became the campaign of the beer. Actually, was the launch of a new beer, as they want to rejuvenate the brand. And it was a platform that was 1 year talking about Rock in Rio and the brands involved in Rock in Rio. Yeah. And since then, that's the DNA of Rock in Rio. So Rock in Rio, more than only a music festival, is a platform that communicates using a lot of media partners. So every country that we are in nowadays, we are in Brazil, Lisbon, Spain, and we are going to US, having our very first edition in Vegas 2015. It will be May 2015. And we are always with a lot of sponsors and brands involved and talking about, you know, Rock in Rio and brands in press during the whole year. So usually Rock in Rio is every other year in the country that we are. So the last edition was in Rio in 2013. We have, you know, 2015, 17 in Brazil. Lisbon, we have now in May 2014, we have an edition in Lisbon that a lot of headliners already confirmed. So you can check it out in rockinrio.com or on Facebook, etc. And we are going to Vegas. So we are beginning 2015 in US. And it will be, you know, every other year in Las Vegas as well.
Yeah. And the US is an interesting market because there are quite a few big established festivals. And so how do you position yourself in the States?
You know, Rock in Rio is a very unique festival. First of all, it's a really premium concept of festival. So if you go there, first we build, we actually build a city. So we call our venue as a rock, City of Rock. And every country that we go, there is a special venue that is constructed to Rock in Rio with a lot of like premium assets. So it's all artificial grass, real toilets, not chemical toilets. And so very unique experience that the audience and the brands can, you know, show up in a very different way that usual festivals position, more a lifestyle and another thing, as I said, we have a lot of media partners involved. So we are starting next March already a campaign to talk about Rock in Rio. And people will understand that there is a really different kind of experience that we offer to this audience.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. And looking at the US as well, you know, you recently started quite a close partnership with SFX in the States. So how did that come about, and how is that affecting the way that you operate and helping perhaps the way that you operate?
Yeah, SFX, you know, Bob Silliman is also a big entrepreneur. So first of all, I think that Roberto, that is the entrepreneur, founder of Rock in Rio, and Bob have a lot of common of being a very creative and very effective in the way they approach the market. So more than, you know, SFX, it's more focused on the EDM market, but we see, you know, together a possible collaboration of Rock in Rio expertise, as Rock in Rio is really unique in terms of the knowledge about communication and sponsorship. Just for you to know, the last edition of Rock in Rio in Brazil in 2013, we raised $52 million in sponsorship. And that is no any other festival or music show in the world that has that kind of investment. And the brands return. So we are partnering always with the same brands for the editions. That what proves that there is return on their investment. So we really know how to use our festival as a platform for brands that wants to be attached to music, and SFX wants also part of their experience to attach to their festivals. And on the other hand, we think that there's a lot of synergies that we can match together. Yeah, they have huge EGM festivals as Tomorrowland, Tomorrowworld. So there are a lot of synergies and that we can put our teams together to explore, not only for the US market, that is the big, you know, project for 2015, but also expanding for other countries.
And next, I chat with Scott Coyne, co-founder and VP of International at The Orchard, about how the company managed to thrive and expand internationally, as well as about its successful YouTube multi-channel network.
You know, a company that was started back in 1997. And so my first question, I guess it's a difficult question, but it's just asking as one of the few companies that from 1997 to today has managed to thrive, sort of how have you succeeded while so many other companies have failed in this space?
How have we succeeded? I mean, again, that is a complex question to answer. But I think one of the things is we've kind of baked into the DNA of the company that change is fundamental. Yeah. That I think a lot of companies over the past two decades, particularly in the media space, keep getting caught because they think they know what it is. So it was the traditional music companies, for instance, that didn't want to transition to digital downloads. But then you see companies that came up in the early 2000s, and then they started to say, now we understand the business, but it changed again. It changed in the mid 2000s with, 2005 plus with the social media, you know, MySpace then, and Facebook and Twitter, and then you come into the streaming, you know, ad-supported services and subscription services like Deezer, Spotify, RDO, now Beats. Throw YouTube on top of it, and it's an ever-changing space, and that's what we're used to. That's what we're expecting. We're expecting that whatever we do today will not be the same as what we do next year.
Because early on in the company as well, you had there were like some big issues when it came to like physical distribution. That you had some troubles with your stocking house as well, and so it's one of those points where, you know, the company could have gone either way, right?
Oh yeah, no. In the very early days, because we never took any financing back in the 90s, it was an incredibly challenging landscape, and yeah, there were moments where we just didn't know how we were going to survive, but we did, and ultimately we've now thrived in this space. And so it's not just understanding that the business is always changing, but also trying to look forward and anticipate where it's going to go. And even I would say not just anticipate, but try and shape what that future is going to look like, not just hoping we guess it right, but actually to build out those elements that people don't even know that they will be needing, but they will later.
So, you know, the Orchard, one of the really interesting parts of the business that's developed over the last few years is your MCN, multi-channel network that you developed over a number of years. The company, of course, has taken its first steps in the video side of things. I think it was circa 2008, 2009, you started like looking at monetization of YouTube videos. And so how did the evolution of that into a multi-channel network come about? Was it deliberate, or did you just end up with a multi-channel network thanks to, you know, the various channels that you developed? And then when the concept came into being of a multi-channel network, you essentially were already there as a company.
Well, it didn't start in 2008. We actually had our first video department in 1999.
Wow.
And it was run by a gentleman called Ron Jarrett at the time. And he's still in film. And we were just incredibly too early. If we were too early in music in the mid 90s, way too early for online video. So we tried it for a few years and then kind of parked it on the side. We waited for, you know, devices, bandwidth, and consumers to be ready to relaunch in a meaningful way. And when we did that, it was always of the intention of, you know, as a distributor, we get lots of different types of content and from lots of different types of content providers. So some's music, some's television, films, action sports videos. And some are combined, music with film. It didn't matter. We just knew that we wanted to provide those services in that space. And because of that, we've built up one of the largest multi-channel networks in the world and always coming in top 10 with YouTube. And I think last year we finished as number 7 globally in YouTube partnerships.
And let's jump to Malaysia, a country that I knew very little about prior to meet them. But here's a chance to learn a little bit more thanks to my chat with the head of the Recording Industry Association of Malaysia, Norman Abdul Halim.
You know, a really great booth here for the Malaysian presence at MIDEM. So how did you end up getting involved with MIDEM in the first place?
Well, first of all, I attended the market sometime towards around 2005, 2006 on my own personal capacity. So, I was appointed as the chairman of the Music Committee, National Development Committee, in about 2 years ago, about a couple of years back. And that was when actually I mooted the idea of actually having our presence here to the Malaysian government. And on behalf of Recording Industry of Malaysia, we represent about 300 record companies. And we would like to see more activities happen outside of Malaysia, especially promoting our music to across the globe. And we've seen some early day success of our artists making their own efforts in Taiwan, China, India, UK, even the US.
Yeah.
So, I think our presence here in MIDEM is actually very important, especially to actually continuously build our presence in the global market space.
Sure. Let's talk about the development of digital music in Malaysia as well. So, what kind of digital services do you have at the moment and what kind of opportunities do you see for growth there?
Well, the big ones are still very much dependent on services provided by the telecommunications companies for the ringback tone business model. That contributes roughly about two-thirds of our income right now compared to physical sales. And I would say that the normal, all the other usual suspects like iTunes, Spotify, Deezer, they're all in Malaysia already.
Yeah.
I think a lot of record companies are seeing revenue from YouTube even.
Yeah.
So I think that generally what you see elsewhere, I mean, we have it in Malaysia. It's just that I think the Malaysian record companies, especially the artists, need to look into content that can travel.
Right.
So especially language is always an issue. And I think that we encourage to do more collaborations and partnerships.
Absolutely. Looking at the way that the industry is structured as well, do you have a big major label presence? Or is it mostly independent labels that are local to Malaysia? How does it work?
We have Universal, Warner, and Sony in Malaysia. They are part of the REM as well. They are also, they sit in the council. But I must say that the contribution from the independent labels are getting more and more significant, especially in terms of exporting music, right? For example, you know, all these artists that I mentioned that actually have done some level of success are actually signed to independent labels. So, of course, Yuna eventually signed to a subsidiary of Universal, but she started up as her own independent label as well. So I think it's the effort made by these Malaysian artists and Malaysian labels and managers actually try to open new territories and new opportunities. Whereas if you were signed to a major label, sometimes you get drowned in the priority list, I mean, the thing is, that's the reality. So I think that in order to see more Malaysian artists to travel, or even composers or performers, I would say that it's actually it's vital to see a lot more effort made by the indies.
And here is my chat with Ken Hertz from Hertz Liechtenstein and Young LLP. We talk first about big data and second about the Transform initiative that he helped shape together with Will.i.am and that launched in Europe at MIDEM.
So looking at, of course, technology can be a fantastic enabler when you're looking at artists that want to capitalize on the audience that they have. So big data is one of the subjects that you are quite interested in. So looking at big data companies like, for example, Next Big Sound or Music Metric in the UK, do you feel like artists are making the most of these platforms yet? And is there still a lot of understanding to be gained when it comes to actually being able to interpret the data that comes from the analytics of these sites?
Okay, so the first, let me dispel the first issue, which is, do I think artists can gain a lot from working with metrics. Of course. In other words, if you're trying to market your music to a fan of this artist, then obviously knowing who are the fans of that artist could be very valuable to you. With respect to what we can learn from the data, you know, I do believe that there is a big success story out there waiting to arrive, where the purveyors of data and those companies that actually collect, analyze, retain data will be able to empower some kind of discovery recommendation technology, which will be extraordinarily valuable, not just to marketers of music, but to consumers of music, but then ultimately to marketers of everything and consumers of everything, right? Because I do believe that lifestyle choices, music, motion pictures, television, books, consumables of all kind, tell us a great deal about, you know, what you've done tells us, and what you like tells us a great deal about what you will do and what you will like. And so whoever figures out how to crack the code in the data area, I mean, we're overwhelmed with data now, but nobody really seems to know what to do with it. I mean, the reason that big advertisers are migrating so reluctantly to digital, right, comparatively speaking, when you think of, when you look at the mind share versus the market share that digital has in the advertising industry, most of that is because of how challenging it is to measure the ROI, to measure the results of the expenditure. The other problem is that you have this crazy reality, which is, you know, it used to be you would buy advertising and you would then pay for it based upon its reach, right? Well, no one's willing to pay an unlimited amount. And the problem with digital advertising is that it has, in theory, an unlimited reach. You know, you put an ad on YouTube and 10 people could see it, billions of people could see it, or millions of people could see it billions of times. How do you pay for that? And how do you measure the investment? And how do you determine how much you should invest in it? It's almost like what they've done is they've bridged this gap between advertisers and content creators, where the advertisers are the content creators. In other words, it used to be the content creators would take the risk of finding the audience, and then the size of the audience would determine how much they could sell their advertising for. Now, the advertisers create the content, and they are taking the risk of finding the audience, and then they have to measure internally what their investment was worth. But you can't predict how big the advertising, how successful the advertising itself is going to be in terms of its reach, let alone how successful it's going to be once it creates a reach on its audience, right? So for advertisers, it's a very complicated situation. I think, you know, the solution, to get back to your question, the solution is data, right? In other words, we are going to find ways of predicting who is interested in what information, who is interested in what kind of content, who is interested in what kind of marketing message. And as soon as we can figure out how to translate that to people who want to spend money, we're going to see a lot of, really, I think, an explosion in the economic size of connectivity. It's just, you know, I think the biggest thing is now, with all of these different services and entrepreneurs, applications, businesses, traditional, non-traditional, competing for our time and our energy and our attention, we haven't yet reached the oversaturation point, but I imagine that we will soon. And then there'll be some kind of a shakeout where, you know, you and I are just not going to have time to do everything, to read our email, to read our Facebook posts, to read our Twitter messages, to read, you know, our various applications, to use our various applications. These are not time savers, they're time eaters. And so, you know, I don't know the point at which either someone figures out how to use data to save us time and make us more productive, or we use data to make choices amongst the various things that we want to do with our time.
And you are one of the shapers of the Trans4M initiative that was subject of a panel here at Medium as well. So can you talk a little bit about what it is and how it came to be?
Okay, so Trans4M is an event that was created originally by Will.i.am in Los Angeles to fund his College Track Center in East Los Angeles in Boyle Heights with Laureen Jobs, Steve Jobs' widow, who runs a fabulous organization called College Track, which takes at-risk kids and helps keep them in school helps them succeed in school, helps them get into college, helps them stay in college, and helps them change their lives. Will raised millions of dollars through a concert and a conference that he held in Los Angeles, and then he held it 2 years in a row, and then this year held the concert again and didn't do the conference. But the concept of Transform is to take our inner cities, take our communities, and take our at-risk kids and help them using science, technology, engineering, and math, and the arts, so what Will refers to as STEAM, to make positive change in people's lives. You know, I think, you know, it's fabulous what he's done. He spoke yesterday, gave a keynote, and then afterwards we had a conversation about how the music industry in particular can effect transformative change in the lives of kids, in the lives of communities, right? The idea of transform originally was transform yourself, transform your neighborhood, transform your community, transform your nation, transform your world.
And finally, here's an extract from my chat with Jordan Berliant from The Collective, talking about Linkin Park's involvement with Music for Relief.
Let's talk about a project that you know, one of your bands has created that you've been particularly proud of, that you've seen over the last year. So, you know, what would you mention to me?
Well, one of the things that I'm particularly proud of is Linkin Park's involvement with Music for Relief, which is a charity that they founded in the aftermath of the 2004 Asian tsunamis. In addition to having raised millions and millions of dollars that have been allocated towards projects to help survivors of disasters on pretty much every continent of the planet, we've really focused very diligently on long-term relief efforts in places like Haiti and places like Japan. And most recently, we held a benefit concert in Los Angeles for the survivors of the recent typhoon in the Philippines. And I'm very, very proud of, you know, to be associated with guys like Linkin Park, whose philanthropic efforts are as important to them as their success and their day job as musicians. And the fact of the matter is that they can combine those two interests to really move the dial and really help save people's lives. Hopefully you'll all see the results of that effort on television, because we did film it for television, and it will start airing within the next couple of weeks. So we've already raised in excess of $500,000 through those efforts, and hopefully the outreach via the television show will help us raise even more money. And again, we partner with non-government organizations who are on the ground to provide a very specific relief effort in the aftermath of these disasters. And the other thing I'm very proud of the guys about is that they actually go to these places to see the results of what these efforts have achieved.
And that's all for this week. I really hope you enjoyed this year's coverage of Medium 2014. And as I said, I will be releasing one video every day during February on YouTube and SoundCloud from the conference. So if you follow the show on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, you'll be able to see when they come out. Once again, I'd like to thank CI for sponsoring DMT's coverage of Medium. It wouldn't have been possible without their support, so go and check out the company's website on ci-info.com. Thanks so much for listening to this week's DMT. Have a fantastic week, and until next time.